This is The Guardian.
Today, cover-ups and government secrets. On Remembrance Day, the forgotten story of one of Britain's greatest wartime betrayals. Yvonne Foley had a happy childhood. She grew up in Liverpool in the 1950s, but she always had this sense that she was different somehow. She had black hair, and in summer, she would tan easily. Her sister was blonde and always got sunburnt. Yvonne was raised by her mum, Grace, and by her adopted dad, Edward, who Yvonne simply knew as Dad. Her parents were both white, and Yvonne didn't really question whether she was too. Not at first.
Must have been about 8 or 9 when somebody else came to live in our street. And I remember going in and said to my mum, "Oh, we've made friends. This is a young Chinese lad." She said, "Oh, he's like you." And I thought, "Pardon?" It just didn't register. I thought, "What's she talking about? He's like me." And then later she said, "Well, he's half Chinese and you are." And I thought, "Oh, I've just lost the plot." Little things happened throughout my life. On one occasion, my dad and I used to love watching a particular programme on TV on a Friday night. It was called The Prisoner.
"You are number 6. I am not a number. I am a free man."
And after it, we'd always discuss it. I remember one Saturday morning, Mum got up and she said, "Oh, you're always arguing. It's just ridiculous. You're just as argumentative as your father." And I said, "My dad doesn't argue." And she said, "I meant your Shanghai father." It wasn't until I was 11. She explained that my real dad was from Shanghai. And my attitude then was, "Oh, well, you know, he's not here. It doesn't matter."
Did your mum ever talk about her relationship with your dad?
She didn't. I think it was too painful. I think she felt she'd been deserted because she didn't talk about it. I mean, who does? You know, if you've been deserted, you think it's your fault. She'd made a life and she had to live it.
Yvonne tried to learn more about her biological father, but nobody seemed to want to talk about it.
I was asking my elderly aunts, could they tell me anything? And their attitude was, "Oh, let sleeping dogs lie. You don't. Why do you want to know? It doesn't matter."
But over time, bit by bit, she pieced together a story. Her dad was an engineer who came from China to work on the docks. He met her mum, Grace, a Scouser, at their church group. They courted for a couple of years. They fell in love. He asked permission from Grace's dad to marry her. Her dad refused, so they eloped. Grace became pregnant with Yvonne and her Chinese dad chose her name.
My father gave me my name because it's a French name and he grew up and lived in the French Quarter of Shanghai.
In 1946, just before Yvonne was born, her dad disappeared. Why he vanished was one thing she never could figure out. Yvonne didn't know it at the time, but she wasn't the only one whose father had vanished from the docks of Liverpool. And years later, her quest to find out what happened to him would lead her to one of the greatest secret injustices in 20th century British history. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the mystery of Liverpool's missing Chinese sailors. The story of Yvonne Foley's mum and dad, at least the part up until her dad's disappearance, a Chinese man meeting a Liverpudlian woman and them falling in love. There wasn't anything that unusual about it in Liverpool, the city with the oldest Chinese community in Europe.
It was a multicultural melting pot. You know, Liverpool's a massive port city, people coming and going all the time, a lot of Scandinavians, there's a lot of Africans, and a lot of people from China, basically, sort of all mingling with the local kind of working class Scousers and sort of Irish immigrants as well.
Dan Hancock writes about cities, politics and culture.
The Chinatown in Liverpool was absolutely thriving. You had a Chinese pub, the Nook, and the landlady, apparently she used to call time in both English and Chinese at the end of the day of drinking.
The number of Chinese people in Liverpool ebbed and flowed throughout the 20th century, mostly corresponding to the level of demand for sailors at any given time. When World War II broke out, that demand went through the roof.
About 20,000 Chinese sailors were signed on, as had happened during the First World War as well, to work on the British Merchant Navy fleet, which went almost entirely out of Liverpool. Historically, their contribution is largely unrecognised, you know, in terms of the Allied war effort. The Chinese have been described as the forgotten ally by some historians. The Chinese seamen were mostly working in the engine room or in the catering corps on these vast, vast vessels that were bringing over huge quantities of food and fuel, without which, you know, Britain would have starved to death. The Nazis' goal in terms of the North Atlantic was to starve Britain by cutting off those supply lines. So you had U-boats positioned, taking down the merchant fleet. With a fair amount of success, people died in their thousands on these ships, including many of the Chinese sailors. They suffered a great deal alongside their British comrades, but they were being paid significantly less. But on the other hand, there was a sort of propaganda effort from Britain at large to sort of say thank you. There was one Chinese merchant seaman called Poon Lim.
The arrival in Britain of the amazing Mr. Poon Lim. To all intents and purposes, Mr. Poon Lim is a dapper little Chinese one might meet anywhere. But now
he became quite famous during the war itself in Britain because his merchant vessel was torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat in the Atlantic, and he spent 133 days adrift on a tiny raft and somehow survived.
Now you know why they had a big reception waiting for him up north when he came to receive the congratulations and admiration of everyone. Natural outcome of this is Poon Lim's visit to Buckingham Palace to receive the British Empire Medal from the King.
And there's this incredible Ministry of Information film which pays tribute to our sort of Chinese brothers in arms.
You've painted sort of a relatively harmonious picture in some ways, in some aspects, but you've got quite an integrated Chinatown. You've got this recognition from the state about, you know, the contribution of these men. How did attitudes towards them change after the war?
So there's quite a dramatic change in the immediate aftermath of the declaration of peace. You've got to, I think, understand the context of Britain, like so much of the world, is absolutely devastated. You know, every third house is a bomb site and has been reduced to rubble. You know, there are millions dead. There's this desperate poverty. And the British state in this context, as it begins to try and sort of creak into action to begin the long, arduous process of post-war reconstruction, the existence of Chinese seamen who had, you know, provided this noble, heroic service for Britain was suddenly like of very little interest, or rather they were not wanted. The attitude of the state and the authorities to these people that they had very specifically brought over to fight in the British war effort was that they were a nuisance and inconvenience.
So did these men, these Chinese seamen who had come over to fight the war, did they settle in Liverpool? Did they all just stay?
For the vast majority of those 20,000 men that helped crew the merchant fleet, they would have been very ready to go home, as you would expect. But during the previous 5 or 6 years, there were some Chinese seamen who had met and married local Scouse women and just sort of become integrated into the community. There were about 2,000 Chinese seamen left in Liverpool at the end of the war. But over the year or two after the end of the war, the rumours started to sort of spread that something was amiss in the Chinese community and people started to disappear. There were stories of men going out from their homes to play mahjong with their friends, or pakapu, which is another like very popular game, sort of gambling game, and then never coming home. There were stories of other seamen sort of going down to the docks, signing on to a new sort of job, and then never coming home again. Some of the wives have told stories of going down to the docks to the shipping office to collect some of the wages which would normally be left behind, and being told, no, we haven't heard of this guy, he's not on a job at the moment, we haven't got any money for you. And they were left perplexed and baffled and thought they'd been abandoned, essentially, that maybe these guys had just, you know, jumped on a ship and abandoned their responsibilities. Some of the women whose husbands disappeared just felt embarrassed about the whole thing, and sort of, you know, a sense of personal shame and betrayal. Absolutely sort of tragic, given what we found out later.
So what did change? What happened?
So we now know, thanks to a tranche of classified yellowing documents from the Home Office, that it was an orchestrated and organised campaign to round up and deport all of the Chinese seamen, irrespective of whether they were married or not. The name of this set of documents is Compulsory Repatriation of Undesirable Chinese Seamen.
So just to clarify, these are men who have settled in Liverpool, they've been part of the war effort, they've got families, they've got children, they've got lives. And then their wives or their partners think that they've been abandoned, but it turns out they've been rounded up and deported by the state.
Yeah, yeah. And the state uses the term roundup at points. What we now know they did is they took them on smaller boats out to these large vessels that were in many cases the same merchant vessels that they had, you know, crewed during the war, risked their lives on during the war. And what the shipping company Alfred Holt did was install sort of bunk beds in the cargo hatches. These weren't like cruise liners. They were designed for carrying vast cargoes,
right,
across the world. Instead, they took vast numbers of men across the world in, you know, incredibly parlous conditions. They sort of basically dumped them on a ship waiting docked in the middle of the Mersey so that no one could escape. And then those ships set sail for, in some cases, Singapore and in some cases, Shanghai. But no information was ever given out to the families of the men that were married. No explanation whatsoever. No attempt for redress or appeal or debate about it.
And how is it described in the actual files? I mean, you've seen them, right? And
Yeah.
Looked at the language that was used at the time. What was it? How was it described, the process of what was going on?
Initially, there's a mood of kind of, you know, this is just part of the cleanup effort, you know, with all of the horrible racist connotations that has. By sort of 1946, with several hundred men already deported, there's a kind of manhunt on for the rest of them, essentially. And, you know, there's one memo that I've found in this Home Office file in the Public Record Office, written by an immigration officer, Liverpool immigration officer, who's writing to the Home Office and assuring them that the job's almost done. He says, quote, "It should not be difficult, if energetic steps are taken, to weed out the remaining men from restaurant kitchens, laundries, etc."
Weed out.
Yeah. It is very stark and very upsetting, the level, the sort of clinical attitude with which these men were dispatched, the lack of care for their wives. There's a very clear classism that overlaps with the racism that is directed towards the men, but also to their, like, often Irish Liverpudlian wives, who were usually from very poor backgrounds as well. There was a line somewhere that many of the wives were thought to be of the prostitute class, therefore who cares? I mean, that's not an exact quote, but, you know, that was very much the atmosphere around these deportations.
Was what was happening even legal?
Chinese seamen who had criminal records in this country, and there were 18 of them out of the 20-odd thousand, and they were usually like minor gambling offences, but those 18 men could be legally deported. The rest of them, as far as I can tell, no. If a Chinese seaman had married a British woman, they did have the right to remain. They didn't have the right to British citizenship, but they did have the right to stay in the country. And what is telling, and is very clear from the Home Office and Liverpool immigration memos, is that they were deliberately avoiding informing the Chinese seamen and their wives about this fact. They were like, we can't tell, can't let it be known in Liverpool's Chinatown that if you're married to a British woman, you're allowed to stay.
It was secretive, it was underhand, and the post-war Labour government authorised what was happening. It was carried out by civil servants, police and immigration inspectors. But beyond that, nobody else was told. The British state tried to keep things quiet, but the efforts weren't wholly successful. By 1946, there appeared to be some local awareness of what was going on. A newspaper article from the period, four paragraphs long, mentions a small protest of the wives of the missing Chinese sailors. Those wives sent a telegram to the Chinese ambassador asking for his help. Nothing came of it. The precise details of the deportations never became public. And while some protested, many of the other wives, people like Yvonne's mother, Grace, were simply led to believe that their husbands had left them and decided to set up a whole new life without their Liverpool families. Many went to their graves thinking this, and children like Yvonne grew up believing that their fathers had abandoned them. That's how the story stayed for decades. It was only in the early 2000s, after most of the parents had passed away, that the surviving Anglo-Chinese children began to hear the truth. The Home Office files were declassified, and Yvonne found herself watching a BBC Northwest documentary investigating the story. It featured interviews with people who witnessed the Chinatown raids and saw men being dragged away to the ships.
I thought, that's interesting. That might be what happened to my father. And that's how it started.
An obsession began for Yvonne. She wanted to try and find out more about her own father and the other Chinese sailors. And so she would travel all over the world, trawling through archives.
We've done research in Shanghai, in Australia, in the USA, in the UK. We've done Maritime Museum, Warwick University, the Union Files. Basically, we're just typing in Chinese and seeing, and whatever came up, we looked at.
Yvonne came across the class snobbery that Dan talked about, including that same document that referred to the wives, people like her mother, as the prostitute class.
That really got me boiling mad.
And in the documents that described men like her father, she also saw racism.
The only time that the hair on my neck stood up, and I'd heard that expression but never experienced it, was when I was looking through the Seamen's Union files of that period, which are held at Warwick University, and the overt racism, it just shocked me. I thought, my God, this is terrible. It was the sort of Fu Manchu type stuff. Mm. And that just, I thought, oh, how dare you? How dare you talk like that or criticise somebody, and A, when you don't know them, and not only that, are you any better? You know, you don't make yourself any better for being like that.
As well as spending hours digging through dusty archives, Yvonne turned detective, tracking down and interviewing the wives and children of the deported men.
Some of the stories were incredibly sad. One lady in particular, a mother, had already been married and had a couple of children. And because this child was very much looked like Chinese, and her other two daughters were fair, if somebody came to the house, she would tell her to go upstairs and play. So it was sort of denying that she was there. Others, whereby they didn't see their mum because their mum had to work two or three jobs. One lady's mum attempted suicide because the thought of being on her own, three children, fortunately, it didn't happen and she survived. There's a whole combination of stories like that, some of them very unhappy.
A few of the people Yvonne spoke to were just about old enough to remember their dads. But their memories are hazy, blurred at the edges. Some don't remember the person exactly, but they have these images of them, frozen in time.
One remembered their father as being a very artistic person. He painted eggshells and he painted inside bottles. And to do that, you've got to be clever and talented, and he was. And she remembers him bathing her and putting a big, lovely towel around her to keep her warm. Another one remembers her father playing the piano I don't remember my father at all, but I remember my mother feeling quite sad because things he'd left behind, she remembered, and like I remember seeing this musical instrument. So my father played music, played Chinese style instruments. I think it's called the zhang. I think a sibling got it out, and which upset my mother. And that came back a flash to me. I remember the machine, I don't remember the person.
A big part of Yvonne's mission to uncover the truth was to help others get some degree of closure. At one stage, she went to a nursing home to speak to one of the last surviving wives.
She'd be getting on to 100 now. And when I met her, she was about 82. And we had a talk, and I explained to her what I'd found out. And she said to me, the nicest thing is about this, in some ways, is even at my age, to think I wasn't deserted. And I think that, for me, was you know, well worth the effort of what I was doing.
Coming up, did any of the deported men make it back to Liverpool? So, Dan, these men were being put on boats and being sent back to China. What was the post-war China that they were going back to like?
They were being deported from a country that was devastated by war into a country that was really just flaring up into a devastating war.
The Communist Peasant Army of a million strong is well-disciplined, zealous, schooled in guerrilla tactics.
The Chinese Civil War, as I understand it, had been sort of bubbling away for some years already, but it was really in the aftermath of the end of the Second World War that it began in earnest.
The Nationalist forces number 3 million men, amply armed, confident of more American support. By mid-1946, the tenuous truce arranged by General Marshall breaks down as mutual political mistrust, followed by renewed shooting, ignites a full-scale civil war.
Many of them were communists. If they weren't being dumped at sort of a communist-friendly port, then there would have been a lot of trouble. And, you know, it's quite likely that many of them died sort of not long after they got back.
When it comes to Yvonne's father and what happened to him, she still doesn't really know that much for sure. She knows that he was called Nan Young. She knows that he was one of the men that was made to leave England in 1946. But one thing she's never been able to find out with any degree of certainty is what happened to him when he got back to China.
I've had Chinese friends and acquaintances saying, well, of course, if he was sort of perhaps in the Union, which I think he might have been, then, you know, he might not have survived. And also the fact that, from what I gather, he'd come from a reasonable family, and an educated family, an educated background. So that wouldn't necessarily have gone down well. So it's pure speculation, sadly. I mean, I've heard loads of stories, and particularly from the Chinese end, of what could have happened or what might have happened and that type of thing. And sadly, we'll never know. I mean, I'll never know. It'd be fantastic if something turned up. But at my age now, I don't expect it.
Yvonne never met her dad. Most of the children never did. But we do know that at least one Chinese sailor did make it back to his family in Liverpool.
There's this remarkable story, a fantastic guy I met, Scouser called Perry Lee, who I would say is in his early 70s now. And his dad, Chan Tan Yon, served in the Second World War on the British merchant ships. He was apparently torpedoed twice.
Wow.
He spent some time in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. You know, he did
a
his
war
bit.
Hero.
Yeah, exactly. A war hero in the most sort of, you know, classical sense. He was one of the men deported, forcibly repatriated in 1946, leaving behind, you know, his partner, British partner, and kids. And then he managed to come back but he did so under an assumed name like 4 or 5 years later. I think it was 1949. He'd been deported once under his actual name, Chan Tan-yeon. And so he came back as Se Pao Lee, which is why Perry Lee's name, surname is Lee. He didn't find out any of this until decades later, he told me, when his old man was in an old people's home, and he asked him to get a gravestone made up, which he was like, "It's a bit morbid, Dad. Why do we need to do this now?" He said, "Because I want my real name on there. I want Chan Tan-yeon on the gravestone. If I'm going to be buried in this country, I want to be buried under my actual name, not the one I made up to evade, you know, the racist British authorities."
What did the adult children that you spoke to want at this stage? I mean, decades and decades after the event, do they expect an apology or some kind of acknowledgement of what happened?
What they want is some kind of justice. From some, there's a sense that, like, you can only get so angry about something that happened so many decades ago.
Nobody's alive that was involved. You can always say you're sorry, but does it mean anything? Really, we've not gone into the blame game because it doesn't do you any good.
And then from others, there's a real anger and frustration and resentment. For some of these children who had their fathers deported, they suffered a great deal throughout their lives. You know, there were many who ended up in care because their mothers couldn't cope. The one sort of uniformity across all of the descendants is they want an acknowledgement that it happened.
And that acknowledgement is something that a number of Liverpool MPs have been asking for quite a few years now. Have they had any success?
Kim Johnson, MP, used a question in Parliament at PMQs to ask the Prime Minister,
"Will the Prime Minister take steps to acknowledge these events and provide the descendants with a formal apology and for the justice they deserve? Thank you, Mr. Speaker."
And was fobbed off in the most pathetic and sort of Boris-y way imaginable.
"Speaker, I have happy memories of my own visits to Liverpool, and I can tell her that we are certainly very grateful across the country to the Chinese community for their amazing contribution, and her message has been heard loud and clear."
Right, let's head to John Stevenson. John.
The sort of breezy statement about how much he loved Liverpool. Like, you know, no, just not even a hint that he'd engaged with the issue or even really knew anything about it. However, by this summer, things have moved on quite a bit, I'm pleased to say. And Kim Johnson, MP, has been pursuing this, along with, you know, there's been a real effort from the descendants to sort of keep the pressure up for an acknowledgement and an apology and for more information to come to light. And Kevin Foster, the Conservative Home Office Minister, did eventually offer his deep regret on behalf of the government.
"And on behalf of the government, can I express our deep regret that some of those would face the most extreme dangers of war to keep our country supplied in its darkest hours were treated in this way."
For Yvonne, some acknowledgement from the government has only ever been one part of this. For her, it's also just about remembering what happened. In 2006, after she was granted permission from the council, she placed a memorial plaque at Liverpool Pierhead. The plaque faces out to sea. It reads in both English and Chinese, "To the Chinese merchant seamen who served this country well, for their wives and partners who were left in ignorance of what happened to their men, for the children who never knew their fathers."
Anybody wishing to lay a wreath may do so now.
Each year, a group of us turn up on the 11th of the 11th and we lay our wreaths there. And it was the least we could do. We felt that it was something to just register what happened, really.
"Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the service, and thank you very much for your attendance. All we always like to do here, we're going to give three rousing cheers for the merchant navy. Hip, hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
My thanks to Yvonne Foley and Dan Hancocks. Do check out Dan's long read, The Secret Deportations, How Britain Betrayed the Chinese Men Who Served the Country in the War, at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.